Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Orbiting. First published in Dude, March 1959. Collected in Tales of Ten Worlds.
Before we start, I'd like to point out something that a good many people seem to have overlooked. The 21st century does not begin tomorrow. It begins a year later, on January 1, 2001. Even though the calendar reads 2000 from midnight, the old century still has 12 months to run. Every 100 years, we astronomers have to explain this all over again. But it makes no difference. The celebrations start just as soon as the 20s go up. So, you want to know my most memorable moment in 50 years of space exploration? I suppose you've already interviewed von Braun. How is he? Good. I've not seen him since that symposium we arranged in Astrograd on his 80th birthday, the last time he came down from the moon. Yes, I've been present at some of the biggest moments in the history of space flight, right back to the launching of the first satellite. I was only 25 then, and a very junior mathematician at Kapustin Yar. Not important enough to be at the control center during the countdown, but I heard the takeoff. It was the second most awe-inspiring sound I've heard in my entire life. The first? Well, I'll come to that later. When we knew we'd hit orbit, one of the senior scientists called for his ZIS, and we drove into Stalingrad for a real party. Only the very top people had cars in the workers' paradise, you know. We made the 100-kilometer drive in just about the same time the Sputnik took for one circuit of Earth, and that was pretty good going. Someone calculated that the amount of vodka consumed the next day could have launched the satellite the Americans were building, but I don't think that was quite true. Most of the history books say that the space age began then on October 4th, 1957. I'm not going to argue with them, but I think the really exciting times came later. For sheer drama, you can't beat the U.S. Navy's race to fish Dmitry Kalinin out of the South Atlantic before his capsule sank. Then there was Jerry Wingate's radio commentary with all the adjectives which no network dared to censor as he rounded the moon and became the first man to see its hidden face. And of course, only 5 years later, their TV broadcast from the cabin of the Hermann Oberth as she touched down on the plateau in the Bay of Rainbows, where she still stands, an eternal monument to the men buried beside her. Those were the great landmarks on the road to space. But you're wrong if you think I'm going to talk about them, for what made the greatest impact on me was something very, very different. I'm not even sure if I can share the experience, and if I succeed, you won't be able to make a story out of it. Not a new one, anyway, for the papers were full of it at the time. But most of them missed the point completely. To them, it was just good human interest material, nothing more. The time was 20 years after the launching of Sputnik 1, and by then, with a good many other people, I was on the moon, and too important, alas, to be a real scientist anymore. It had been 12 years since I'd programmed an electronic computer. Now I had the slightly more difficult task of programming human beings, since I was chief coordinator of Project Ares, the first manned expedition to Mars. We were starting from the moon, of course, because of the low gravity. It's about 50 times easier in terms of fuel to take off from there than from the Earth. We thought of constructing the ships in a satellite orbit, which would have cut fuel requirements even further, but when we looked into it, the idea wasn't as good as it seemed. It's not easy to set up factories and machine shops in space. The absence of gravity is a nuisance rather than an advantage when you want things to stay put. By that time, at the end of the 70s, the first lunar base was getting well organized, with chemical processing plants and all kinds of small-scale industrial operations to turn out the things the colony needed. So we decided to use the existing facilities rather than set up new ones, at great difficulty and expense, out in space. Alpha, Beta, and Gamma, the three ships of the expedition, were being built inside the ramparts of Plato, perhaps the most perfect of all the walled plains on this side of the moon. It's so large that if you stand in the middle, you could never guess that you were inside a crater. The ring of mountains around you is hidden far below the horizon. The pressure domes of the base were about 10 kilometers from the launching site, connected to it by one of those overhead cable systems that the tourists love to ride on, but which have ruined so much of the lunar scenery. It was a rugged sort of life in those pioneering days, for we had none of the luxuries everyone now takes for granted. Central Dome, with its parks and lakes, was still a dream on the architect's drawing boards. Even if it had existed, we would have been too busy to enjoy it, for Project Ares devoured all our waking moments. It would be man's first great leap into space. By that time, we already looked on the moon as no more than a suburb of Earth, a stepping stone on the way to places that really mattered. Our beliefs were neatly expressed by that famous remark of Tsiolkovsky's, which I'd hung up for everyone to see as they entered my office. Earth is the cradle of the mind, but you cannot live in the cradle forever. What was that? No, of course I never knew Tsiolkovsky. I was only 4 years old when he died in 1936. After half a lifetime of secrecy, it was good to be able to work freely with men of all nations on a project that was backed by the entire world. Of my 4 chief assistants, one was American, one Indian, one Chinese, and one Russian. We often congratulated ourselves on escaping from security and the worst excesses of nationalism, and though there was plenty of good-natured rivalry between scientists from different countries, it gave a stimulus to our work. I sometimes boasted to visitors who remembered the bad old days, "There are no secrets on the moon." Well, I was wrong. There was a secret, and it was under my very nose in my own office.